friends. Welcome to the first 2013 edition of The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and we're going to jump right into the new year with a literary shape-up of our physical, emotional, and financial health. It's time to look forward. We are psyched and ready for self-improvement on all levels. As always, books lead the way, so let's journey on as we turn to page one of The Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. What did Charles Darwin, an underachieving second son, do to become one of the world's greatest naturalists? What were similar choices made by Mozart? In Mastery, Robert Greene mines the biographies of great historical figures for clues about gaining control over our own lives and destinies. Greene culls years of research and original interviews to blend historical anecdote and psychological insight, distilling the universal ingredients of the world's masters. Martha Graham, Henry Ford, and so many more all have lessons to offer about how the love for doing one thing exceptionally well can lead to mastery. Yet the secret, Greene maintains, is already in our heads. Debunking long-held cultural myths, he demonstrates just how we, as humans, are hardwired for achievement and supremacy. Fans of Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers will eagerly devour this erudite explanation of just what it takes to be great. Fred Sander narrates.
Toward the end of April 1519, after months of illness, the artist Leonardo da Vinci felt certain that his death was only a few days away. For the past 2 years, Leonardo had been living in the Chateau of Clou in France, the personal guest of the French king, François I. The king had showered him with money and honors, considering him the living embodiment of the Italian Renaissance, which he had wanted to import to France. Leonardo had been most useful to the king, advising him on all kinds of important matters. But now, at the age of 67, his life was about to end, and his thoughts turned toward other things. He made out his will, received the Holy Sacrament in church, and then returned to his bed, waiting for the end to come. As he lay there, several of his friends, including the king, visited him. They noticed that Leonardo was in a particularly reflective mood. He was not someone who usually liked to talk about himself, but now he shared memories from his childhood and youth, dwelling on the strange and improbable course of his life. Leonardo had always had a strong sense of fate, and for years he had been haunted by one particular question. Is there some kind of force from within that makes all living things grow and transform themselves? If such a force in nature existed, he wanted to discover it, and he looked for signs of it in everything he examined. It was an obsession. Now, in his final hours, after his friends had left him alone, Leonardo would have almost certainly applied this question in some form or another to the riddle of his own life, searching for signs of a force or a fate that had brought about his own development and guided him to the present. Leonardo would have begun such a search by first thinking back to his childhood in the village of Vinci, some 20 miles outside Florence. His father, Ser Piero da Vinci, was a notary and staunch member of the powerful bourgeoisie. But since Leonardo had been born out of wedlock, he was barred from attending the university or practicing any of the noble professions. His schooling, therefore, was minimal, and so as a child, Leonardo was left mostly to himself. He liked most of all to wander through the olive groves around Vinci, or to follow a particular path that led to a much different part of the landscape, dense forests full of wild boar, waterfalls cascading over fast-moving streams, swans gliding through pools, strange wildflowers growing out of the sides of cliffs. The intense variety of life in these forests enthralled him. One day, sneaking into his father's office, he grabbed some sheets of paper, a rather rare commodity in those days, but as a notary his father had a large supply. He took the sheets on his walk into the forest, and sitting upon a rock, he began to sketch the various sights around him. He kept returning day after day to do more of the same. Even when the weather was bad, he would sit under some kind of shelter and sketch. He had no teachers, no paintings to look at. He did everything by eye, with nature as the model. He noticed that in drawing things, he had to observe them much more closely and catch the details that made them come to life. Once he sketched a white iris, and in observing it so closely, he was struck by its peculiar shape. The iris begins as a seed, and then it proceeds through various stages, all of which he had drawn over the past few years. What makes this plant develop through its stages and culminate in this magnificent flower, so unlike any other? Perhaps it possesses a force that pushes it through these various transformations. He would wonder about the metamorphosis of flowers for years to come. Alone on his deathbed, Leonardo would have thought back to his earliest years as an apprentice in the studio of the Florentine artist Andrea del Verrocchio. He had been admitted there at the age of 14 because of the remarkable quality of his drawings. Verrocchio instructed his apprentices in all of the sciences that were necessary to produce the work of his studio: engineering, mechanics, chemistry, and metallurgy. Leonardo was eager to learn all of these skills, but soon he discovered in himself something else. He could not simply do an assignment. He needed to make it something of his own, to invent rather than imitate the master.
That was Mastery by Robert Greene. Nate Silver built an innovative system for predicting baseball performance, predicted the 2008 election within a hair's breadth, and became a national sensation as a blogger, all by the time he was 30. In The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't, Silver examines the world of prediction, investigating how we can distinguish a true signal from a universe of noisy data. Most predictions fail because most of us have a poor understanding of probability and uncertainty. I know I do. Both experts and common folk mistake more confident predictions for more accurate ones. But overconfidence is often the reason for failure. If our appreciation of uncertainty improves, our predictions can get better too. This is the prediction paradox. The more humility we have about our ability to make predictions, the more successful we can be in planning for the future. In keeping with his own aim to seek truth from data, Silver visits the most successful forecasters in a range of areas, from hurricanes to baseball, from the poker table to the stock market. He explains and evaluates how these forecasters think and what they share. What lies behind their success? Are they good or just lucky? What patterns have they unraveled? The Book Report, and the book world in general, believes Nate Silver's insights, performed by Mike Chamberlain, are an essential listen.
The instinctual shortcut that we take when we have too much information is to engage with it selectively, picking out the parts we like and ignoring the remainder, making allies with those who have made the same choices and enemies of the rest. The most enthusiastic early customers of the printing press were those who used it to evangelize. Martin Luther's 95 Theses were not that radical. Similar sentiments had been debated many times over. What was revolutionary, as Elizabeth Eisenstein writes, is that Luther's theses did not stay tacked to the church door. Instead, they were reproduced at least 300,000 times by Gutenberg's printing press, a runaway hit even by modern standards. The schism that Luther's Protestant Reformation produced soon plunged Europe into war. From 1524 to 1648, there was the German Peasants' War, the Schmalkaldic War, the 80 Years' War, the 30 Years' War, the French Wars of Religion, the Irish Confederate Wars, the Scottish Civil War, and the English Civil War, many of them raging simultaneously. This is not to neglect the Spanish Inquisition, which began in 1480, or the War of the Holy League from 1508 to 1516, although those had less to do with the spread of Protestantism. The 30 Years' War alone killed one-third of Germany's population, and the 17th century was possibly the bloodiest ever, with the early 20th staking the main rival claim. But somehow in the midst of this, the printing press was starting to produce scientific and literary progress. Galileo was sharing his censored ideas, and Shakespeare was producing his plays. Shakespeare's plays often turn on the idea of fate, as much drama does. What makes them so tragic is the gap between what his characters might like to accomplish and what fate provides to them. The idea of controlling one's fate seemed to have become part of human consciousness by Shakespeare's time, but not yet the competencies to achieve that end. Instead, those who tested fate usually wound up dead. These themes are explored most vividly in the tragedy of Julius Caesar. Throughout the first half of the play, Caesar receives all sorts of apparent warning signs, what he calls predictions. Beware the Ides of March. That his coronation could turn into a slaughter. Caesar, of course, ignores these signs, quite proudly insisting that they point to someone else's death, or otherwise reading the evidence selectively. Then Caesar is assassinated. But men may construe things after their fashion, clean from the purpose of the things themselves, Shakespeare warns us through the voice of Cicero. Good advice for anyone seeking to pluck through their newfound wealth of information. It was hard to tell the signal from the noise. The story the data tells us is often the one we'd like to hear, and we usually make sure that it has a happy ending. And yet, if the tragedy of Julius Caesar turned on an ancient idea of prediction, associating it with fatalism, fortune-telling, and superstition, it also introduced a more modern and altogether more radical idea, that we might interpret these signs so as to gain an advantage from them. Men at some time are masters of their fates, says Cassius, hoping to persuade Brutus to partake in the conspiracy against Caesar. The idea of man as master of his fate was gaining currency. The words predict and forecast are largely used interchangeably today, but in Shakespeare's time, they meant different things. A prediction was what the soothsayer told you. A forecast was something more like Cassius's idea. The term forecast came from English's Germanic roots, unlike predict, which is from Latin. Forecasting reflected the new Protestant worldliness rather than the otherworldliness of the Holy Roman Empire. Making a forecast typically implied planning under conditions of uncertainty. It suggested having prudence, wisdom, and industriousness, more like the way we now use the word foresight. The theological implications of this idea are complicated. But they were less so for those hoping to make a gainful existence in the terrestrial world.
We've just heard The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver. Andrew Weil, MD, is a world-renowned leader and pioneer in the field of integrative medicine, a healing-oriented approach to healthcare encompassing mind, body, and spirit. Combining a Harvard education and a lifetime of practicing natural and preventive medicine, Dr. Weil is the founder and director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona Health Sciences Center in Tucson, where he is also a clinical professor of medicine and public health. Online, he is the editorial director of DrWeil.com, the leading web resource for healthy living based on the philosophy of integrative medicine. As a columnist for Prevention magazine and a frequent guest on many TV shows, Dr. Weil provides valuable information and insight on how to incorporate conventional and complementary medicine practices in one's life to optimize the body's natural healing power. Dr. Weil donates all of his after-tax profits from royalties from sales of Weil Lifestyle directly to the Weil Foundation, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to supporting integrative medicine through training, education, and research. Approximately 10 million copies of Dr. Weil's books have been sold. And now we have True Food, written with Sam Fox, founder and CEO of Fox Restaurant Concepts, and James Beard-nominated restaurateur, and Michael Stebner, executive chef of all of True Food Kitchen restaurants. Each recipe has a twofold mission. It must be delicious and must also promote the diner's well-being. Welcome, Dr. Weil. I'm thrilled to have you join us on the Book Report.
Happy to be here.
Tell us about True Food, the restaurants, and True Food, the book.
I've always been a very good home cook, and over the years, people have said you ought to open a restaurant. I was smart enough to know I knew nothing about the restaurant business, and it looked tough. But 4 years ago, I was introduced to a very successful restaurateur, Sam Fox. I proposed to him the concept of a restaurant that would serve really delicious food that was also healthy. He didn't go for it. He said, health food doesn't sell. I think he thought I meant tofu and sprouts. So I invited him and his wife to my home for dinner. I cooked for them. He liked the food. He said he was willing to try it, but he was very skeptical. We opened the first True Food Kitchen in Phoenix over three years ago. It was wildly successful from the go. He was astounded by this, and we've now got six of them. We just opened one in Denver. We'll be opening ones in Dallas, Boston, Washington, and many other cities in the next couple of years. I think the reason these restaurants are popular is that, first, that the food is really delicious. It's affordable. We use fresh, local, sustainable ingredients, bold flavors, and it happens to be good for you. You feel good after you eat there. We don't, you know, emphasize the fact that this is healthy food, but it conforms to the principles of good nutrition and cutting-edge science.
What are the biggest challenges you face in trying to change American eating habits?
The biggest one is very simple. It's that people think that eating healthy means giving up everything you like, and that's absolutely not true. But I think unless you've had such food, you don't believe it. So a lot of us have been served really dreadful stuff that we've been told is good for us. I have developed an anti-inflammatory diet, which I think is your best shot at optimum health and maximum longevity. It's based on the Mediterranean diet, which is a very delicious and satisfying. I've added Asian influences to it to make it even more effective. And, you know, all of the recipes in the restaurant and in the book conform to those principles.
Well, I noticed that you identified kale salad as the signature dish of True Food Kitchen, yet many of us have never eaten kale. What are your tips for this dish?
Well, you know, first of all, this is a recipe I brought back from Tuscany. It's a traditional Italian recipe. It uses a variety of kale called black kale, which is, I think, easier, friendlier than some of the traditional varieties that are in markets here. But the trick of this recipe is that the kale is shredded, and it sits for at least 15 minutes in a dressing that contains olive oil, lemon juice, and salt. The lemon juice and salt take the bitterness out of the kale and soften it, turn it green, and then this is mixed with garlic and red pepper and Parmesan cheese and some breadcrumbs. Absolutely delicious. We serve an incredible amount of it, and kids love it, which is amazing. Who would ever have thought that American kids would be eating raw kale?
Yeah. Well, how difficult do you think it's going to be for Americans to move away from refined, processed, and manufactured foods?
The problem is that we've made the unhealthiest food cheapest and most available, and people are going to eat what's cheap and what's available. I think as a country, we have to really figure out how to make higher quality, healthier food more available and more affordable. A good place to start would be ending federal subsidies to commodity crops like soy and corn, and instead to subsidize fruits and vegetables to make them affordable. But, you know, there's so many things that we've got to change. The first step, I think, however, is to give people the experience of really good food that happens to be good for you. And I would love to see people get back in the kitchen and start making this. And I've tried to include in the book many recipes that are really simple, not many ingredients, no complicated cooking techniques, and the results will come out as beautiful as the photos.
It's true. I mean, the recipes for me, I'm not a fabulous cook, look really doable, and the photos are amazing. And I want to also thank you for including some cocktail recipes in the book.
We serve very creative drinks at the restaurant and also non-alcoholic beverages. I think that that include, you know, very healthful herbs, spices. People love them.
I noticed the recipes don't include calorie counts. Have you got any reader feedback from that?
No, actually not. And, you know, we are doing nutritional analyses of all the recipes at the restaurant, and we'll provide that information on request. But I don't count calories. I think that the goal is to get the right balance of fat, carbohydrate, and protein, to eat the right foods in the right portions. And, you know, it's not that complicated. If people want to lose weight, the simplest advice is to cut back or try to eliminate products that are made with flour and sugar.
What's your opinion on supplements? It seems that nearly every day there's a change in what we should do and what we shouldn't do.
Well, I am a great, first of all, supplements are not substitutes for the whole foods that contain them. And taking supplements does not excuse you from eating a good diet. I'm a very careful shopper. I cook a lot of my own food. I grow a lot of my own food. And I also take a daily multivitamin, multimineral as insurance against gaps in my diet. And I think that's really what they're useful for.
Final thoughts?
Well, I would just love to see people try these recipes and see how easy they are and how great the results are, and serve them to your family, and I think you'll be very pleased.
I think so, too. I know I'm going to try some recipes. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Weil.
You're very welcome.
And now we'll preview a popular title from Dr. Weil, Spontaneous Happiness. Everyone wants to be happy, but what does that really mean? Increasingly, scientific evidence shows us that true satisfaction and well-being come only from within. Dr. Weil believes the best way to maintain optimum physical health is to draw on both conventional and alternative medicine. And this book is a reinterpretation of the notion of happiness, with an array of scientifically proven strategies from Eastern and Western psychology. Drawn from psychotherapy, mindfulness training, Buddhist psychology, nutritional science, and more, these strategies include body-oriented therapies to support emotional wellness, techniques for managing stress and anxiety, and changing mental habits that keep us stuck in negative patterns. Dr. Weil, who narrates, presents an 8-week program with short and long-term advice on nutrition, exercise, supplements, environment, and lifestyle.
I hear the words, "I'm depressed," very often, from patients, friends, colleagues, acquaintances, and strangers, and I've uttered them myself on more than one occasion. But what do people mean when they say they're depressed? For some, it's nothing more than a way of describing a bad day or being bummed about the weather or about a favorite sports team's loss. Others are admitting they suffer from a chronic mental illness that can be incapacitating. In between is a broad spectrum of negative moods and emotional states, including sadness, pessimism, and the inability to experience pleasure or maintain interest in the potentially joyous and rewarding aspects of life. The root meaning of the verb depress is to push down. To be depressed is to have one's mood or spirits lowered. Who or what does the pushing? And how can we define down except as relative to something else? What is the emotional equivalent of sea level, from which point all positions above or below can be measured? Are we better off hovering near that level, or should we strive to stay above it? These questions interest me greatly in my ongoing efforts to both come to terms with the changing contours of my own emotions and understand why so many people today are experiencing depression. Also, I'm not sure how to respond to the question, "Are you happy?" which I get asked frequently. Happy might mean content, joyful, blissed out, or simply not sad. And how happy am I, or is anyone, supposed to be? There are self-assessment tools designed to help individuals determine their level of happiness, but I find it frustrating to answer the questions and don't find them useful. There are a great many books offering ways to attain happiness, and no shortage of books about depression and its treatment, with or without popular drugs like Prozac. This book is different. It is about emotional well-being, and it is informed by the new science of integrative mental health, a field I helped develop. Integrative mental health works from the general philosophy of integrative medicine, beginning with an emphasis on the human organism's innate capacity for self-regulation and healing. Integrative medicine views mind and body as inseparable, two poles of one human being. It takes into account all aspects of lifestyle that influence health and risks of disease. It also makes use of all available methods to maintain health and support healing, both conventional therapies and alternative ones for which there is scientific evidence of efficacy. I understand health as a dynamic condition of wholeness and balance that allows us to move through life and not succumb to malfunctions of our own physiology or suffer harm from all the potentially damaging influences we encounter. If you are healthy, you can interact with germs and not get infections, with allergens and not have allergic reactions, with toxins and not be harmed. Moreover, a healthy person has a reserve of energy that allows for fulfilling engagement with life. The essential qualities of health are resilience and energy. When I describe health as dynamic, I mean that it is always changing, allowing the organism to find new configurations of balance as external and internal conditions change. Physiologists use the term homeostasis to designate this dynamic self-regulation of living organisms. Thanks to it, our bodies are able to maintain relatively constant temperature, blood sugar, tissue chemistry, and so on, despite great variations in environmental conditions and demands. If, as I believe, mind and body are most usefully viewed as two aspects of the one reality of our being, then homeostasis must also be essential to optimum emotional health. By drawing analogies from the science of physiology, and by using the principles of integrative medicine, I will try to answer the questions I raised earlier in this introduction. Let me start by pointing to some new findings about the function of the human heart. Throughout history and in many diverse cultures, people have regarded the heart as the seat of emotions. Our language reflects this association: heartwarming, heartbroken, heartaches, and heart throbs. In written Chinese and Japanese, the same character denotes both heart and mind. We often feel strong emotions in our chests, probably because continual hormonal and nervous communication between the heart and brain links the activity of these organs.
We've just heard Spontaneous Health by Dr. Andrew Weil. Increasingly, Americans are discovering just how unhealthy our diets have become. In The Jungle Effect, the healthiest diets from around the world, why they work, and how to make them work for you, Daphne Miller, MD, travels around the world in search of native cuisines that address the Western ailments that plague her patients. This is an exciting culinary adventure, one that reveals the health and well-being benefits of eating a less processed, more natural diet. Dr. Miller does a compelling job of suggesting ways to incorporate native foods into everyday living, and Dr. Andrew Weil has written the foreword. The book is read by Heather Hathaway.
If a diet book is a book that proposes a healthier way to eat, then this is a diet book. And yet, this is not a diet book in the traditional sense of the word. Browse through the health and nutrition section of any bookstore, and you will find that most diet books, whether they're intended to help you lose weight, transition through menopause, or fight heart disease, have one thing in common. They have eating plans that have been invented at a recent point in time by one or a few individuals. This book is quite different. The foods and eating plans recommended are not based on the ideas or observations of a doctor, chef, nutritionist, or supermodel, nor are they based on laboratory experiments with humans or rats. Rather, they've been developed over centuries by indigenous people living on the land in remote places around the globe. Mind you, the inspiration for this book did not start with a specific intention to write about indigenous diets, nor did it start with a fascination with isolated cultures, an urge to travel, or a conviction that natural or native is necessarily healthier. Instead, it started in my medical office in San Francisco in response to seeing so many frustrated patients men and women who are desperately trying to change their diet to lose weight or deal with a chronic health problem. Most of them had tried dozens of fad diets, but had not discovered a healthy way to eat that they could stick to for the long run. For years, I felt I had little to offer them. But then, as luck would have it, I met Angela. If not for Angela, I might never have thought about the importance of cold spots or the healing value of indigenous diets. I certainly would not have set out on the around-the-globe nutrition adventure that has culminated in this book. Angela was born in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, the eldest of five children. Her mother was originally from Italy but had grown up in Rio, while Angela's father, whose ancestors were Maoist Indians, had been raised in a tiny village on the banks of the Amazon River. As far back as Angela can remember, she was overweight, hence the nickname Porquinho, or piglet, that was given to her by her cousins and classmates. She blamed her girth on her mother, who loved to cook heavy, multi-course meals with pasta, all kinds of cheeses, stewed meats, and always a big pastry for dessert. Her father, a physical education teacher, would encourage Angela to play sports, but she usually felt tired and found excuses not to participate. When Angela was 8, her parents separated. Her father moved to the United States, and her mother, overwhelmed by the five children under her care, decided to send Angela to live with her father's relatives in the rainforest. At first, Angela recalled feeling isolated and lonely in her new home. She was depressed about her parents' divorce, hated being sent away, and missed the city and her siblings. She longed for her mother's rich cooking and resented the fact that fruit was considered a dessert, and breakfast featured fish soups, taro, and beans rather than sweet rolls. Then, as the months passed, Angela started to become accustomed to life in the jungle. She recalls many happy moments playing tag with her cousins along the river's edge. As she describes it, "I started to enjoy the food and discovered I really loved living there. Slowly, I began to feel like I had more energy. One day, I saw myself in the mirror and was shocked. I looked so good. I looked like a normal-sized child."
We've just heard The Jungle Effect by Dr. Daphne Miller. For all of us who resolve to be better parents in 2013, the book report presents a preview of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity by Andrew Solomon. An utterly original thinker, Solomon's journey began from his experience of being a gay child of straight parents. He wondered how other families accommodate children who have a variety of differences. Those who are prodigies, have disabilities, are transgender. Book ended with Solomon's experiences as a son, and then later as a father. The author describes individuals who have been heartbreaking victims of intense prejudice, but also stories of parents who have embraced their children's differences and tried to change the world's understanding of these conditions. Bill Clinton says, quote, "In Far From the Tree, Solomon reminds us that nothing is more powerful in a child's development than the love of a parent. This remarkable new book introduces us to mothers and fathers across America, many in circumstances the rest of us can hardly imagine, who are making their children feel special no matter what challenges come their way," end quote. The author narrates the book that has been selected by the New York Times as one of its top 5 nonfiction books for 2012.
Attributes and values are passed down from parent to child across the generations, not only through strands of DNA, but also through shared cultural norms. Ethnicity, for example, is a vertical identity. Children of color are in general born to parents of color. The genetic fact of skin pigmentation is transmitted across generations, along with a self-image as a person of color, even though that self-image may be subject to generational flux. Language is usually vertical, since most people who speak Greek raise their children to speak Greek too, even if they inflect it differently or speak another language much of the time. Religion is moderately vertical. Catholic parents will tend to bring up Catholic children, though the children may turn irreligious or convert to another faith. Nationality is vertical, except for immigrants. Blondness and myopia are often transmitted from parent to child, but in most cases do not form a significant basis for identity. Blondness because it is fairly insignificant, and myopia because it is easily corrected. Often, however, someone has an inherent or acquired trait that is foreign to his or her parents, and must therefore acquire identity from a peer group. This is a horizontal identity. Such horizontal identities may reflect recessive genes, random mutations, prenatal influences, or values and preferences that a child does not share with his progenitors. Being gay is a horizontal identity. Most gay kids are born to straight parents, and while their sexuality is not determined by their peers, they learn gay identity by observing and participating in a subculture outside the family. Physical disability tends to be horizontal, as does genius. Psychopathy, too, is often horizontal. Most criminals are not raised by mobsters and must invent their own treachery. So are conditions such as autism and intellectual disability. A child conceived in rape is born into emotional challenges that his own mother cannot know, even though they spring from her trauma. In 1993, I was assigned to investigate deaf culture for the New York Times. My assumption about deafness was that it was a deficit and nothing more. Over the months that followed, I found myself drawn into the deaf world. Most deaf children are born to hearing parents, and those parents frequently prioritize functioning in the hearing world, expending enormous energy on oral speech and lip reading. Doing so, they can neglect other areas of their children's education. While some deaf people are good at lip reading and produce comprehensible speech, many do not have that skill, and years go by as they sit endlessly with audiologists and speech pathologists instead of learning history and mathematics and philosophy. Many stumble upon deaf identity in adolescence, and it comes as a great liberation. They move into a world that validates sign as a language and discover themselves. Some hearing parents accept this powerful new development. Others struggle against it.
We've just heard Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. Kari Loya is an athlete, educator, adventurer, and talented storyteller. He is also an Emmy-winning voiceover artist. To celebrate a birthday milestone, Kari wrote My Top 40 at 40, Making the First Half Count. In this entertaining book, Kari shares experiences we can all relate to and adventures we've all dreamed about. It just might inspire you to get out there and start racking up incredible stories of your own. Welcome, Kari. Thanks so much for joining us on the Book Report today.
Hi, Elaine. I'm thrilled to be here.
So the book is an answer to the question, how should I celebrate my 40th birthday? Talk about that for a bit.
Exactly. About 5 years ago, I was starting to think about how I wanted to celebrate the big 4-0. I love parties. I love to travel. And I thought maybe I'll do something about rafting the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. But when I started to think about it, and I thought, what would be the most fun, meaningful way to celebrate a birthday? I said, well, shoot, let me stop and get on paper all of the wonderful adventures that I've already had. And so I basically took over the last couple of years, got on paper all of these stories that I already shared with my family and friends, record for posterity. And it's a chance to take stock of the first half of my life, think a little bit about what I want to do in the second half, and get fired up to go out and get those stories as well.
Well, you have traveled so extensively, and your stories in the book include tales from Mozambique, Dubai, Guatemala, Argentina, all over the place. Don't you credit all these far-flung locales with improving your stories? And can someone who's never traveled still tell incredible stories?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because that's one of the big misperceptions out there, that adventure and learning, you have to go to the Himalayas to discover that. Going to these different places is wonderful because it opens your eyes. You don't need to do it on a luxury budget. You can do things on a shoestring budget, and a lot of people do that. In the meantime, I'm always amazed at how there are folks who travel around the world, but when you're just staying at the five-star hotel and on an airline and an airport, you don't really learn a lot. and you could just travel 2 miles in your own city and have an incredibly rich experience seeing things you've never seen before, you know, right here, whether you're on the coasts, in the middle of America, wherever.
All right, let's talk about storytelling. What are the elements that make a great storyteller?
Oh, boy, that is a wonderful subjective question. What I think is compelling content, something that will grab your attention quickly. You know, the great Isabel Allende, I once heard talk about the power of storytelling, and she spoke of teaching some challenging kids a number of years ago, and she opened with the four magic words, once upon a time. And so when you're able to grab people with kind of a hook early, that's the start. But then you want to have something that I think opens their eyes. You want to have detail, as much detail and specificity. But I think the most important thing is the best stories are passion. You are passionate about communicating something that you have learned, you have lived, and you want to share it with others. And often that comes across then.
Well, can you share a favorite story from the book?
Boy, I've got everyone always asks what's my favorite, and I say each one is my favorite story for that particular part of my life. I think one that I have to single out then is a steamy love story, which is about how I met my wife down in Argentina. And I was down there to climb Aconcagua, which is the highest peak outside of the Himalayas. And I was flying in from Santiago into Mendoza, just across the Andes. And anytime you get near Argentina and Brazil, there's a lot of beautiful women. And so sure enough, I get on the plane and I see a number of beautiful women. But there's one in particular that caught my eye. And so we landed in Argentina, and I was thinking of, you know, how could I strike up a conversation during customs there? Nothing happened. I went off for 2 weeks, hanging out with Boris, Igor, and others on a mountain in tents. But 2 weeks later, I'm flying out of the country. I go back to Mendoza Airport, and there among the hundreds of people is the same lady I was checking out earlier. And I say, no way. And so I ended up, to kind of make a long story short, ended up sitting down outside the gate. We ended up being on the same flight. And in a three-minute conversation, I learned that she was heading back to Los Angeles. I was heading back to New York. And we had a lot of other things in common. She got off in Santiago. I thought we'd continue our conversation, but I was going to stay there. And she went on. I didn't see her waiting for me. I was disappointed for about 5 seconds. And then I said, well, wait a minute. I know where she works, and I know her first name. When I got back to New York, a week later, I looked up on the Internet, found her on the Internet, found an email, struck up an email conversation. That turned into phone conversations. We were bi-coastal for a year and a half, and it culminated with our wonderful three-day James Bond theme wedding down in Argentina.
Which I know you write about in the book. You won an Emmy for doing voiceover. How did you get into the voiceover business?
Voiceover is something that started in about high school and college when folks would comment on voice quality. And, you know, the kind of the classic thing is, you may have a great piano, but can you play it? And so in college, I had a woman who was filming our speeches come up to me afterwards and said, did you ever think about doing voiceovers? And it was the first time I heard that term, even though I knew exactly what she was talking about, because I always loved going to the movie theater and hearing the, you know, In a World of Terror, all of that good stuff. So when I got out to L.A. to teach for America, I started taking classes, acting classes, voiceover classes. And then you saw that one of the stories, ironically, is that four houses down from us, we were living in the Hollywood Hills, four elementary school teachers of all things, this fortress went up, and it was the new home of Don LaFontaine, the legendary king of voiceovers. And so one of the stories is about the day that when I went down and, rat-tat-tat on his door, which the steel structure and I hear a voice through the box. The woman says, hello, and I say, hi, is Mr. LaFontaine there? And a pause for 10 seconds, and sure enough, through the box I hear, hello. And I'd say, hi, Mr. LaFontaine. My name's Corey Loy. I just wanted to welcome you to the neighborhood. And, oh, I'm also interested in voiceovers. And suddenly the vault opened up. And there stood Don LaFontaine. He goes, voiceovers? Hi, I'm Don. Come on in. And he gave me a tour of his place, and we met again a number of years later. But that's how I got into it.
Well, for those who aren't familiar with him, what might we have heard with him being the voice?
Oh, Don LaFontaine used to do, well, he became visible here about 5-6 years ago when there was a Geico spot that was kind of a parody, and he was he actually appeared on camera. But he used to do probably 60% of all movie trailers, 50% of all movie trailers. He used to do the network promos for NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, telling us all to watch these great things because they're absolutely amazing.
I was speaking to my daughter yesterday, and she ended a conversation with, I'm dealing with my quarter-life crisis, and I just love that. What advice would you have for her and her contemporaries?
My quarter-life crisis.
Yeah, don't you love that? Yeah.
It's funny you say that because I spoke with someone about 3 months ago who talked about entering the third quarter and the challenges of entering the third quarter. And that's as I've divided my book into halves, I think a quarter is great, and there are different challenges at each phase. I think probably the most important thing is to have a long-term perspective on everything. It is a big world. Everyone is a great person, and there's a wonderful opportunity to get out, explore, listen to yourself, be true, but explore, connect with people. If you're interested in something, go for it. Worst case, you won't like it. Worst case, you'll fail. But then you find more closely what you want to be doing.
Yeah. Well, you've got a really great website. Share that with the listeners.
Yeah, one of the things about the website is for each of the 40 stories, we put up a story teaser. And so there's kind of an intro. You talked about the power of storytelling, and I talked about kind of having a hook. Each of the 40 stories, you can click on there, and you can read the first paragraph. See whether or not that particular topic will be of interest. But on top of that, then, at the end of each story, there are multimedia bonus adventures. So when you're if you're reading a hardcover version, you can go online. Or if you're reading a Kindle version or iPad version, you can just simply, you've just read a story about, the adventure in Guatemala. Well, now you can click, and now you're seeing the photos of that Guatemala trip. And I also recorded an author's audio commentary for each story as well, so you can learn a little bit more. And there's some video components and other multimedia enriched content.
And tell us the address.
Yes, the address is www.mytop40at40.com. And that's 40 at 40.
Well, readers, this is a really fun book, My Top 40 at 40. Pick it up. And thanks so much for joining us, Corey.
Thanks so much for having me, Elaine.
All righty. All right. Bye.
Spark, the revolutionary new science of exercise in the brain, is a groundbreaking investigation into the transformative effects of exercise on the brain from best-selling author and renowned psychiatrist John J. Rady. Did you know that you can beat stress, lift your mood, fight memory loss, sharpen your intellect, and function better than ever by simply elevating your heart rate and breaking a sweat? The evidence is incontrovertible. Aerobic exercise physically remodels our brains for peak performance. In Spark, Dr. Rady journeys through the mind-body connection, presenting research to prove that exercise is truly our best defense against everything from depression to ADD, to addiction, to aggression, to menopause, to Alzheimer's. It's filled with amazing case studies. Spark may change the way you think about your morning run, or for that matter, simply the way you think. So get ready to get moving. Walter Dixon narrates.
It was already known that exercise increases levels of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, important neurotransmitters that traffic in thoughts and emotions. You've probably heard of serotonin, and maybe you know that a lack of it is associated with depression. But even many psychiatrists I meet don't know the rest. They don't know that toxic levels of stress erode the connections between the billions of nerve cells in the brain, or that chronic depression shrinks certain areas of the brain. And they don't know that Conversely, exercise unleashes a cascade of neurochemicals and growth factors that can reverse this process, physically bolstering the brain's infrastructure. In fact, the brain responds like muscles do, growing with use, withering with inactivity. The neurons in the brain connect to one another through leaves on tree-like branches, and exercise causes those branches to grow and bloom with new buds, thus enhancing brain function at a fundamental level. Neuroscientists have just begun studying exercise's impact within brain cells, at the genes themselves. Even there, in the roots of our biology, they found signs of the body's influence on the mind. It turns out that moving our muscles produces proteins that travel through the bloodstream and into the brain, where they play pivotal roles in the mechanisms of our highest thought processes. They bear names such as insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, and vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, and they provide an unprecedented view of the mind-body connection. It's only in the past few years that neuroscientists have begun to describe these factors and how they work, and each new discovery adds awe-inspiring depth to the picture. There's still much we don't understand about what happens in the microenvironment of the brain, but I think what we do know can change people's lives and maybe society itself. Why should you care about how your brain works? For one thing, it's running the show. Right now, the front of your brain is firing signals about what you're listening to, and how much of it you soak up has a lot to do with whether there is a proper balance of neurochemicals and growth factors to bind neurons together. Exercise has a documented, dramatic effect on these essential ingredients. It sets the stage, and when you sit down to learn something new, that stimulation strengthens the relevant connections. With practice, the circuit develops definition, as if you're wearing down a path through a forest. The importance of making these connections carries over to all of the issues I deal with in this audio program. In order to cope with anxiousness, for instance, you need to let certain well-worn paths grow over while you blaze alternate trails. By understanding such interactions between your body and your brain, you can manage the process, handle problems, and get your mind humming along smoothly. If you had half an hour of exercise this morning, you're in the right frame of mind to sit still and focus on this paragraph, and your brain is far more equipped to remember it. Everything I have written over the past 15 years has been aimed at educating people about their brains. Your life changes when you have a working knowledge of your brain. It takes guilt out of the equation when you recognize that there's a biological basis for certain emotional issues. On the other hand, you won't be left feeling helpless when you see how you can influence that biology. This is a point that I keep coming back to with my patients, because people tend to picture the brain as a commander mysteriously issuing orders from an ivory tower, untouchable from the outside. Not at all.
We have just heard Spark by John J. Rady. What are you afraid of? The old rules. Play it safe. Stay in your comfort zone. Find an institution, a job, a set of rules to stick to. Keep your head down. Don't fly too close to the sun. The new truth. It's better to be sorry than safe. You need to fly higher than ever. In the Icarus Deception, How High Will You Fly?, Seth Godin writes his bravest and most challenging book yet. Godin shows how we can thrive in an economy that rewards art, not compliance. And he makes a passionate argument for why you should be treating your work as art. Art is not a gene or a specific talent. It's an attitude available to anyone who has a vision. Steve Jobs was an artist. So were Henry Ford and Martin Luther King. To work like an artist means investing in the things that scale: creativity, emotional labor, and grit. The path of the artist isn't for the faint of heart, but Godin, who narrates, shows why it's your only chance to stand up, stand out, and make a difference.
How long are you going to wait? They told you to get your resume in order, to punch your ticket, to fit in, and to follow instructions. They told you to swallow your pride, not to follow your dream. They promised trinkets and prizes and possibly riches if you would just suck it up and be part of the system, if you would merely do what you were told and conform. They sold you debt and self-storage and reality TV shows. They sold your daughters and sons, too, all in exchange for what would happen later when it was your turn. It's your turn. You are not your career. Your ability to follow instructions is not the secret to your success. You are hiding your best work, your best insight, and your best self from us every day. We know how much you care, and it's a shame that the system works overtime to push you away from the people and the projects you care about. The world does not owe you a living, but just when you needed it, it has opened the door for you to make a difference. It's too bad that so much time has been wasted, but it would be unforgivable to wait any longer. You have the ability to contribute so much. We need you now. Does anyone have any suggestions? We've all heard this request at the end of a meeting. Sometimes the moderator even means it. Sometimes the moderator, the boss, the person with a problem, actually wants to know if the group has an untried concept or an insight to share. And the response is always the same. Silence. Sidelong glances, perhaps some shuffling of papers, but still, silence. Really? All these highly trained, well-paid, and respected people in a room, and not one person has something to contribute? I doubt it. Stick around for a few minutes, and if the moderator has earned any trust at all, someone speaks up. And if that person isn't summarily executed, someone else speaks up, and then more people, until finally the room is filled with energy, a buzz that you can feel. Finally, we're permitted to be human, to end the silence, to share our best work. Amazingly, everyone in the room is capable of seeing and analyzing and solving. Everyone in the room is capable of passion. Everyone in the room can care enough to do something if they can overthrow the self-induced, systematically amplified censor that keeps them in line. Why didn't anyone speak up earlier? Why did we have to wait until the meeting was over? Where does the strained silence come from? This isn't a program for other people. This is a program for you. It's a program for anyone who has been overlooked or brainwashed or seduced into being invisible. A revolution is here, our revolution, and it is shining a light on what we've known deep down for a long time. You are capable of making a difference, of being bold, and of changing more than you are willing to admit. You are capable of making art. Green eggs and ham. This might not work. This program might not hit its mark, or it might not be direct enough, or it might be too direct. I've gone outside my comfort zone in writing and recording it, and I'm hoping you'll go out of your comfort zone in listening to it. I'm trying to help you see something that's all around, but something that you may have missed, something you may be intentionally ignoring. I'm working to get more people to taste something they haven't wanted to taste, to experience a different way of working and thinking about the work we do. It's so tempting for me to smooth out the edges, to make this work safe and obvious and comforting. I wish I could make the program easy and guaranteed and reach everyone I want to reach. I can't do that, though. This revolution is too important to allow me to water down this project. Thank you for letting me take the risk of writing and recording this program. And thank you for taking the risk in giving it a try.
That was The Icarus Deception by Seth Godin. Readers, it's a new year, a fresh start, and we're on our way towards a more positive outlook. It will be my privilege as your literary guide to keep you current on books that can help, inform, and entertain. I know I'm hopeful for the year ahead. Let's continue the journey together next week on The Book Report.